This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and you can find them anywhere in this country. I think our last program, we heard from a gentleman who spent most of his life in the Florida Keys, and now we're on the exact opposite end of the lower 48, about as southwestern as you can get in California, Coronado Island, which has been the lifelong home of 93-year-old Tom Rice, a World War II paratrooper, and a guy who still likes jumping out of airplanes. But let's go way, way back. You're born in August of 1921, growing up out here in San Diego, in Coronado. What was it like in Coronado in the 1920s and 30s?
The city in which naval aviation was born.
Mm-hmm.
This was a city that will take care of you and look after you. For the most part, we were coddled here in the Coronado. We were protected.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned military courtesies in a big hurry in this city.
And you probably saw a lot of planes flying around.
Oh, sure. Yeah, North Island is attached to Coronado, and so they were coming in and going out all the time.
You were a distance runner for the Islanders of Coronado High way back when?
Yeah, I ran the, as a B-class runner, a young kid, I ran the 1320, which was a three-quarter mile. I did pretty well in that, and I earned my way to the state meet in Los Angeles. I got fourth in the state meet in the three-quarter mile.
Not bad, fourth in the state.
Yeah. Then the senior in high school, I ran all the track meets as dual meets and invitational meets, and one of them was at Huntington Beach. I got second at Huntington Beach in a 50 school activity in the mile. I broke the school record, but it was not allowable because there were not enough watches on me. It have to be three watches if you're going to break a record. And the coach was the only one that had a watch on it. So I didn't get the record at that time.
Well, that's a bummer. What was your time?
I think 4:36.
Uh-huh.
Which wasn't bad that time in the 1940. That was,
yeah.
We're talking 1940 now.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty good run.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just guessing, if you were that good at distance running during that time period, did you have some dreams of maybe running in the Olympics someday?
Not the World Olympics, but while I was in the Army, as the war wound down, there was a Third Army Olympics. So I ran 5,000 meters in the Third Army Olympics in the Nuremberg Stadium.
Huh.
I got second place there. Another fellow from the 101st Airborne Division beat me about 20 yards.
Oh.
I couldn't make that one up. But interesting sideline is that as a tour that Brenda and I took, we ended up in Nuremberg on a miserably cold day. A tour guide told about the Nuremberg Stadium, and I said to him on the side that I ran here in 1945. So he put me on. And so I told a story of about 10 minutes there while all the people shivered while we was running in the Nuremberg Stadium. That was a good recall for me.
Yeah. Well, and you've got a few of those, and there are so many stories I want to hear from you. But there's one question that I like to ask every veteran that I have the privilege of interviewing. It's about a specific date because everyone seems to remember it. December 7th, 1941. Where were you? How'd you find out that America was under attack?
I was on a basketball court early in the morning with four other fellas with a portable radio. We heard it over the radio. That just stunned us. We stopped the game, went home, and picked it up at home from there on. Because this is a Navy community, and that was the buzz right away. This community is based on and founded on naval aviation.
Mm-hmm.
So it went around very fast here.
How big of a shock to the system was that? What did it mean to you?
Not as much as I thought it would, because we got so many things to do in front of us. Going to school, running track. We weren't eligible yet for any military duty. We were just to find out what the rest of the people were doing and who was going and when they were going.
Mm-hmm. When did it occur to you that you were going to be part of this war effort?
after 2 years of college.
Where'd you go to college?
At San Diego State Engineering Department. I ran on the freshman track team.
But you didn't get to finish with the Aztecs because Uncle Sam was ready for you?
I was ready for him.
Uh-huh. So, you made the decision.
Yeah, I made the decision. I volunteered for airborne activities. You see, I was a risk taker.
You know, for someone who skydives every year on D-Day, I could see that you have that credibility as a risk taker.
My father was stationed in the Panama Canal Zone in 1934. He was killed in an aircraft accident.
Oh, no.
So
you're just a teenager and you lost your father.
Yeah, I was 12 years old then. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, I was on my own father-wise from that point on.
I would think when you hear your dad dies in an aircraft accident overseas that an airplane's the last place you want to go.
No.
What made you such a risk taker?
It was the focus of this community.
Uh-huh.
This community was based on aviation.
Sure.
So we were a good bunch of kids here. This was not a gangland area. We were a crowd rather than a gang.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of parties, a lot of dancing, a lot of school parties. North Island was our focus. Hotel Del was our focus. The girls dressed in formal. And we had so many formal dances, we couldn't recognize the girls in the same dress. They traded dresses. And we got them corsages every time.
Uh-huh. You know?
So we had a great time in this city.
Well, and you talk about the aviation focus of the community. Did you ever think that you were going to become a pilot? That's what your calling was?
No, I just saw the long span of types and kinds of activities. So I knew that this was boots on the ground. I knew that we were going to go into combat in some unusual manner and way, and that was part of the risk that I had learned to take since I was on my own.
And maybe some people don't realize it now, but this was really a new thing. The idea of a paratrooper, of someone who jumps out of an airplane behind enemy lines and fights his way to where he's supposed to be, that had never happened before World War II.
It was an experimental. The United States Army was trying to develop a million-man airborne army.
Tell me about the training, because obviously, being a distance runner, you were in tremendous shape already, but something tells me there had to be some challenges throughout the time you spent training for the paratroopers.
Well, it was pathos there, and it was humor. The moment we got to our destination in Camp Tocoa, Georgia, they took us to a C-47 body with a 36-foot ladder, and you were required to climb that, go into that nacelle. You put on a parachute harness only. Just outside the open door on the other side of the aircraft where you entered was a 200-yard steel cable and a big pulley on it. So they connected you to the cable. You stood in the door, and the instructor gave you instruction. We were 36 feet in the air, and we had a 15-foot suspension. So you'd fall 15 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Telling us to look out, have the hands outside the door framework. Look out, don't look down. And that was the first test. By looking out, and if you did look down, you could see an inchworm, and that scared them out. That was the challenge right there. So I never looked down. I looked out. When they swatted me on the derriere, you were to take one step out into the open air, your arms folded across the reserve chest, your chin on your chest, and count to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. And then to transfer a D-ring from your left hand to your right hand. If you drop that D-ring, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So we floated on down to the end of the cable detachment. We grouped there with about 5 to 10 people, and we went to the colonel. The colonel wants to know, what are you here for? And he expected an answer to kill the Germans, you know. But nobody was that enthusiastic about that because we didn't know what we're getting into. If you pass the colonel in all his questions, he was looking for athletes and college kids.
Uh-huh.
He had no time to make silk purses out of sow's ears.
Mm-hmm.
He had to get the upper crust as best he could. So fortunately, I fit that pattern because I was in college, 2 years of college, engineering department, and I had a pretty good background in running. And the regiment that was forming now was the 501 Parachute Infantry. From Camp Tocoa, we went to Fort Benning, Georgia, and we had 4 weeks there. Our physical training was pretty tough. We'd be out there in the field, and we're doing all kinds of exercises. And the drill instructors were muscle-bound Apollos, and they wore T-shirts three times too small, so their muscles would stand out all over. So if we did something wrong in the ranks, the drill instructor would give us 25 push-ups. Mm-hmm. We annoyed them by telling them or asking them, which arm, sir?
Nice.
So we went through phase A, which was physical training, pretty fast because we were in good shape. Then B and C and D were more technical. D was five parachute jumps. And
were those from those famous jump towers from the World's Fair that they took down to Fort Benning?
Oh, yeah, you know about those towers.
I've seen them, yeah.
Yeah, they brought those in. And a couple of the exercises there where you lie down, you're on a parachute harness, then you raise you up 50 feet with a reserve on front of you with a D-ring. You pull the D-ring and it's exchange hands. If you drop that D-ring, they move you 50 feet higher.
I guess that helps you remember to not drop the D-ring.
If you don't do it right there, they move you up to 150 feet.
Wow.
If you don't do it there, I don't know if they move them to 200 feet or not. But I think maybe at 150 feet, you're doing things wrong. They brought you down again and gave you a good lecture. And maybe if they thought well of you, they might try it again.
Did any of that ever happen to you?
No, nothing happened. I was able to get through that without any trouble. I mean, you do it with great tension and strength and focus, you know, because you're looking down on those guys. These towers had four arms, you remember. And one of the towers had a large basket-shaped parachute and a parachute put inside of it and a skirt attached to the exterior area of the ring of the design. And they would raise you up to 250 feet and then give you instructions, do this, and you would be floating free. But they were cautious about the direction of the wind because you could be blown into the tower itself. So they only used the arms were clear of the wind. And so we had fun doing that.
You had fun doing that. It wasn't nerve-wracking? It wasn't scary?
No, we're getting kind of used to some of these things. We know we're being tested all the time, so we're under tension quite a bit. We're trying to outdo the guy next to us, too.
Sure.
No failure, you know.
Was it a pretty big deal when you qualified, when you made it through all that training?
Oh, yeah. The first one was nerve-wracking. I think I jumped number four. And you jump over the landing field there and right alongside of Chattahoochee River. The thing that we were concerned with, the Chattahoochee River, 1,200 feet, looks like it's part of the landing field. And there were incidents where some of the guys made preparation for a water landing when they were 50 feet in the air.
Ooh. How were your landings?
Hard.
So. Is there anything that prepares you for that, for what that feels like?
Well, we did parachute landing falls. We were attached to a harness on a cable, and we would slide down the cable, and the instructor would pull the trigger mechanism and release. We didn't know when we're going to be released, so we would drop down about 8 or 9 feet and then make a right shoulder arm, right shoulder a roll on it, and then come up standing at attention. So if you did something wrong there, you got 25.
I bet.
Then which arm, Sergeant?
Yeah, right or left.
Well, I'm sure with the kind of shape you're in, you could get 25 in while we're taking our first commercial break. 93-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California is our guest. When we come back, from training to taking off late at night on June 5th, 1944, ready to jump behind enemy lines as part of the massive D-Day invasion. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live.
live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.